Okay. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Senate Committee on Rules for Wednesday, June 26th. And we have three bills under consideration today. Because of the lateness in session, all these bills are posted for a work session, but we will be taking limited testimony on them. So I will begin by opening a work session on Senate Bill 488. And Lori, could you tell us about this bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 488 repeals the sunset on the provisions related to low carbon fuel standard. There's no revenue impact. There's a fiscal statement issue that is attached by hard copy to your SMS.
Great. Thanks, Lori. And I think we have a small panel of people who wanted to testify on this. And so I'll call them together, and I'll call Annette Price and Joel Fisher and Christy Split. The three of you would like to come forward. Thank you for being here. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Annette Price. I'm the State Affairs Manager for the Port of Portland, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 488. We testified before the House Energy and Natural Resources Committee earlier this session, and Environment and Natural Resources Committee, and the reason we're supporting this, the Port of Portland has been engaged for over a decade in alternative fuels in the state of Oregon. And as a matter of fact, back in 2002, we were instrumental in helping establish the B20 biodiesel market in the state of Oregon. We believe that we are in a low-carbon fuel future and support this bill. So I'm happy to answer any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Fisher, senior policy analyst at the Oregon Business Association, although I'm not actually senior to anybody there. Here to testify in support of the Clean Fuels Program, Senate Bill 488, removing the sunset and allowing the program to move forward. Oregon Business Association has been a supporter of this program since way back in 2009 when it was first passed. We see this, as kind of marrying two fields of economic development as well as incentivizing a sustainable environment and protecting the environment in Oregon. Studies have shown that this could create somewhere between 8,000 and 29,000 jobs in Oregon. We currently are not producing any fuel here in Oregon, but incentivizing using this program, we could see more biofuels companies. We think that we could become a hub, much in the subway, same way that Adidas and moved here in the 80s when Nike was becoming so influential in the footwear and apparel, that we might be able to see more companies locating here. Already companies are passing Oregon up instead going to California and investing there, where they have a similar program known as the Low Carbon Fuel Standard. So we'd like to see this program, the sunset lifted, the program able to continue. We've heard that people said that, well, what about the rising price of gasoline? Will this program cost more? We think that adding and diversifying different fuels to our fuel supply will be a great opportunity for us to actually stabilize the price of fuel, if not bring it down. There's a consumer protection provision in the bill that would say if the price of gasoline rises above 5% for three consecutive days, that the program would be discontinued. And I would just note that if you've watched the price of gas, it has gone wildly outside of that 5% in the last couple months, a couple of different times. So Oregon Business Association is supportive of this program, and we urge your support. Thank you.
Thanks for your testimony.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Christy Split. I'm the coordinator for the Oregon Conservation Network. The Oregon Conservation Network is a coalition of 44 groups from around the state with unique missions, each of them. And this year, we selected Senate Bill 488 as a priority for a healthy Oregon by a consensus process. All of our organizations feel that this bill, because it deals with climate change, affects the missions of all 44 organizations. And we like to say it's not just a priority for a healthy Oregon. It's our number one priority this particular session. And that's because of the partnership potential, the economic development potential that comes with the win for, that we see for the environment. The Clean Fuels Program passed in 2009, as those of you will remember, all of you were there for that. And in 2009, the bill was passed with a sunset. But what it does, just as a reminder, is it requires Oregon's fuel mix to become 10% less carbon intensive over a decade. And how do we reach that goal? Any way that industry can get there. That means investing in advanced biofuels, biogas, propane, or other clean technologies. OCN also cares deeply about the public health, and I want to make sure to mention that as well. Transportation emissions create chronic health problems for many Oregonians. There's 17 air toxics above health-based benchmarks in Oregon, and diesel-fueled engines, just as one example, emit more than 40 air toxics. We know that cleaner fuels can improve the health of Oregonians by preventing asthma and other conditions. So we're excited to not just join the Oregon Business Association and the Port of Portland and 100 organizations around the state in supporting the bill. We also enjoy working with the American Lung Association on this bill because of the public health benefits. So we have a chance for a win-win today, and we're happy to answer any questions. We're all glad to be here together for Senate Bill 488 today.
Great. Well, thank you for being here on kind of short notice that we're operating under toward the end of session. I did want to just clarify, because I'm looking at the bill, and I didn't see the provisions about, and they may be linked to other statutes, the provisions about if the price of fuel were to go over a certain amount, that this would be suspended. Is that in this, or is it in some...
It's in the bill that was
passed. It is.
Take it. Okay. So when we passed the bill in 2009, we directed DEQ to develop the Clean Fuels Program, and they've had a robust stakeholder process since the 2009 session to develop a set of prospective rules. We've adopted some of those rules just as far as collecting data and information in order for us to move forward with the program when the sunset's lifted. But in addition to that, DEQ put together an in-writing and have distributed an idea that they have that they would implement with the sunset removal when they implement the program, a rule that would use information gathered by the Department of Energy regarding fuel prices in neighboring states, and with as short of 3 days' notice, they could shut down the program completely if we have a fuel spike related to the Clean Fuels Program. And I actually will happily, I'll ask DEQ to send it so that it comes from them to the entire committee so that you all can see that plan that they have developed.
Okay. Thank you. I think that clarifies that. Any questions? Okay. Looks like you've answered them all. So thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 488? Okay. And it looks like committee administrator is referring me to...
This is directed to you, just that... position from Senator Boquist entered into the record.
Okay. We have an email from Senator Boquist expressing his opposition to this bill. Okay, so I don't have anyone else signed up to testify, and all of our paperwork is in order. Is that correct, Lori?
It is.
And so we are in a work session.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 488 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Beyer has moved Senate Bill 488 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Any objection to the motion?
I object, Madam Chair.
Okay. I thought that might be the case. So, Mike, would you please call the roll?
Senator Beyer?
Yes.
Senator Burdick?
Aye.
Senator Starr?
Excused.
Vice Chair Farioli?
No.
Chair Rosenbaum?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill moves to the floor. Senator Beyer, would you carry this on the floor?
Be happy to.
Thank you. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 488 and open a work session on House Bill 2418A. Lori?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2418A modifies the definition of supervisory employee for purposes of public employee collective bargaining law, specifies public employee prohibited from striking who merely assigns, transfers, or directs works of another and does not have authority to impose economic discipline on employees, is not a supervisory employee. The dash A8 is attached, and it adds an emergency clause and revises the provisions defining supervisory employee.
Okay, thank you, Lori, for that explanation.
Just wanted to let you know, Madam Chair, excuse me, that we do have a revenue impact, but no fiscal impact statement on the amendment.
Okay, so we are not in possession of all the paperwork we would need to be able to put this out today, and I think we were given to believe that it was unlikely it would be available by close of business today. Okay, so it looks like we have a couple of people who want to testify, and I'll call them both together. Bob Livingston, Brian DeLashman.
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, as you well know, I'm Brian DeLashman. I represent the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Oregon State Police Officers Association, commonly called the Troopers Association, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers. This is not a new issue. This bill was debated in previous sessions, debated earlier this session in the Senate Committee, General Government and Consumer Protection Committee, was moved to this committee. Obviously, this is a very important bill for us, and I'll be extremely brief, but let me give you a couple of parallels. What we're really talking about here is the ability for somebody who truly is not a supervisor, in the case of police officers, who goes out on a normal patrol, and I'm talking about sergeants. We don't specifically name sergeants in this, but in some jurisdictions, sergeants may in fact have some responsibilities that would disqualify them from being in the bargaining unit. But in many jurisdictions, sergeants typically do the same kind of patrol duty as a senior trooper, a trooper, or a patrolman in any jurisdiction. And they're exposed to the same types of situations, use of deadly force, situations that a normal patrolman who is in a bargaining unit or potentially could be in a bargaining unit would have. The difference, however, is that when they're excluded from the bargaining unit, they have absolutely no protections. They're at-will employees, whereas in an officer-involved shooting, and I have a number of cases from around the states in the last 10 years plus, in which you had a sergeant who was there on the scene and a patrolman who was there on the scene. Both of them discharged their weapons. They're treated entirely differently. And the union officer has the immediate protection of not only his union contract, but also has the attorney available to them from the union that's an expert in this particular field, whereas the sergeant does not have those protections. Let me give you a parallel. As you probably also well know, for a number of years I've represented the Oregon Nurses Association. I see a very distinct parallel between what we're talking about here and what we're talking about nurses. If you look at existing statute on collective bargaining, registered nurses, you'll see a passage in the statute that was passed 750 a number of years ago in 1995 that specifically says a registered nurse, just by the fact that they supervise other employees, is not considered a supervisor. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. In the case of police officers, sergeants often direct the work, but they're not truly supervisors. They are directing some work of others, but not true supervisors. And with that, I'll turn it over to Bob. Let me give you one additional thought before I do that. Recently, we became aware that the state of Oregon, actually through the governor's office staff and the state police, actually moved to bring their sergeants back into the bargaining unit. And one of the impacts that we've said that's been the downside of not having sergeants in the bargaining unit is that you have no inclination because of the exposure to actually promoting. And so we've found for a number of years you have senior troopers in OSP who are not promoting to sergeant because they knew they had did this. They were up doing the same job as a senior patrol officer but had absolutely no coverage at all legally. What has happened since they've changed that and now the sergeants are back in the bargaining unit? The last posting that they had for an opening for a sergeant had 11 applications. The previous posting that they had for a sergeant, they had one applicant. So exactly what we said was the plus side of making this change, in fact, is coming true simply because the state of Oregon, through its wisdom, decided to go to allowing the sergeants to be back in the bargaining unit, therefore allowing the flow of expertise and command to flow upwards like it should. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. Just quickly, to Brian's point, certainly one of the things that we believe is good about this bill is what he mentioned, particularly with the sergeant says OSP as an example, but certainly with successor planning. As somebody that is a public safety officer in the state, we do know that since 1995, the impacts of the change in the supervisory definitions has had a deleterious effect on those individuals that maybe not all the best and brightest are promoting up through the ranks. And unfortunately, the bar has been set at such a low standard. And in the general government committee, we had an expert, not only a professor, but a labor attorney that basically acknowledged that when you compare Oregon to other states, our definition of supervisory is very stringent and unfortunately at a too low of a level keeps people from promoting up through the ranks. So not only will this bill, in my opinion, and I think it's proven, particularly in the fire service, this bill will improve that successor planning, which I think is a good issue not only for the safety of the public safety officers, but for the overall good of the state as it relates to those individuals that are in an important profession. Finally, Madam Chair, I would just speak specifically that we certainly support the -A8 amendments. This helps to further clarify some of the things that we've heard not only previously but in the past years. It would add the words hire and discharge as primary indicia along with imposing economic discipline. And it further clarifies that city police department employees with a city population less than 14,000 are not subject to this paragraph. And with that, I appreciate your opportunity to communicate on this bill, and certainly encourage you to pass this to the floor when you have the paperwork, and would be happy to take any questions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for these witnesses? Okay, it looks like you answered them all. Thanks very much for being here. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2418? Yes, please come forward. And you have friends. Good to have friends, especially at this stage of the session. Okay, good afternoon. Welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities, and I'm appearing in opposition to House Bill 2418-A and the amendment. I apologize, I'm not as well prepared as I would like to be, but we just got these, and so I will endeavor to do my best. I wanted to respond to a couple of points. The current definition of a supervisory employee is not unique to Oregon. This is the definition that's in ECPA right now, is the exact definition that is in the National Labor Relations Act. And basically what it says is that if you have the ability to perform certain functions, hire, fire, direct, some other things, you are a supervisory employee. But it also requires that the person have independent judgment in doing so. And we believe that independent judgment is a fairly high bar. And if you look at the ERB rulings over the past several years, you'll see that the ERB has not always sided with management in these negotiations. In point of fact, if ERB finds that a police officer is performing essentially the same function with some supervisory component to it, but is spending most of their time doing the same sorts of work, that person properly belongs in the bargaining unit. And that's there's the sisters case. Conversely, what they have found is that if an employee, say in the city of the Dalles, the sergeants were found to be, they didn't have economic discipline authority, but they were responsible for the work of subordinates. They were directing shifts. They were calling people in on overtime, activating emergency response teams, these sorts of things. And those were supervisor employees. And I think that would fit any colloquial definition of the word supervisor. Reserve my comments. I'll turn this over to my colleagues, but we still have significant concerns over this legislation.
Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, Michael Eisen, Association of Oregon Counties. I'll be brief. We've testified in several different committees this session on this bill. We are opposed to House Bill 2418, just got the Dash A8 amendment, so we're still looking it over, but on first glance, it's apparent we'll still be opposed. We simply have situations in certain counties where potentially only the sheriff has the ability to impose economic discipline. Under this bill, it creates the possibility that everybody but the sheriff could be moved into a bargaining unit, and we don't see that as a step forward. We're not sure that the system is broken, as the proponents describe. So we are still opposed to this bill, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, for the record, Andy Smith for the City of Portland. Thanks for the opportunity to say a few things about the bill and the amendment. Our read of the amendment is that intentionally or unintentionally, it's still likely to impede the important work on police accountability that's underway right now at the City of Portland. The amendment, by focusing on only three things that supervisors actually rarely do, diminishes all of the other important work that supervisors do that is recognized in the current statute. And as Scott mentioned, the Employment Relations Board is already applying the current statute in a way that gets at the issue of lead workers by saying that independent judgment is a critical factor in delineating between who is and who is not a supervisor. We think this helps get at the issue proposed to raise without the unintended consequences on police reforms. To that end, we sat down with the proponents and had conversations about a way to focus this bill on the central issue that's been identified by the proponents, which is the issue of lead workers. And those ideas are not reflected in these amendments, and for those reasons, we continue to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. And I'm sorry, I was distracted by a question, and so I didn't hear the last part of your testimony about what you meant about other changes to the bill that dealt with lead worker that you don't see reflected here.
Chair Rosenbaum, what I was saying is that the Employment Relations Board is applying the current statute in a way that gets at the issue of lead workers by saying that independent judgment is a really important thing to look at when you're doing these functions to say if you're a supervisor or not. And to that end, we sat down with the proponents of this bill and said and put forward some ideas to really focus the bill on that issue. And those ideas that we put forward are not reflected in the amendment, and that's why we continue to oppose.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these good folks?
Madam Chair.
Yes, go ahead, Senator Burdick.
I was curious, the mayor has made some statements about wanting to do some reforms in the police department. I don't know if you're prepared to say how this would interact with those efforts, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about that if you are ready to do that.
Sure. Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, you know, I think that from our point of view, you know, the mayor has made police reforms a top priority of his. And, you know, I think that that he feels like he needs a management team that is committed to implementing the changes that need to be made under the federal mandates from the United States Department of Justice. He needs a management team that's committed to making those and is responsible to the organization and to the public, and doesn't have that inherent conflict of interest of also being responsible to a bargaining unit.
Thank you.
Okay, additional questions? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2418? Okay, seeing no one, and the fact that we lack the fiscal impact statement, we cannot do anything with this bill today. So I think we will carry it over to our next hearing, which at this point looks like it'll be 9:30 tomorrow morning, and we'll repost for tomorrow. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2418. And then are we switching chairs again?
Nope,
we are staying put. Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 3342. And Jana, could you tell us about this bill?
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, House Bill 3342 came to you from the Senate General Government Consumer and Small Business Protection Committee. We are still awaiting the fiscals on the Dash 3 amendments, so again, you may want to carry this one over. The underlying measure prohibits a public employer from engaging in or using public funds to deter, support, assist, or promote union organization. It prohibits the employer from using public property to hold meetings related to union organizing unless the property is available without charge as a meeting place for the general public. It prohibits retaliation for enforcement of the measure. It directs the Bureau of Labor and Industries to adopt rules necessary to implement the measure. It would allow wholly or any Oregon taxpayer to take civil action for a violation. It requires the Employment Relations Board include in existing bargaining units those employees who are not members of the unit but seek to be included in the unit if the majority of employees seeking inclusion sign a petition. It declares emergency effective July 1st, 2013. You have the proposed Dash 3 amendments, which remove the prohibition on public employer engaging in actions to assist, promote, or deter union organizations. They just specifically cannot use funds for that, for those actions. It removes the prohibition on the use of public property for such activities. It specifies an employer may offer an opinion on union organizing if it is upon request of an employee. It allows the paying of wages to a represented employee when employee is performing duties if that payment is permitted under a collective bargaining agreement. It changes the enforcement and rulemaking authority from the Bureau of Labor and Industries to the Employment Relations Board. It removes the requirement of written notice prior to filing suit for violations of the measure. It specifies the resident of the state may intervene as a plaintiff in the action, but removes the ability for any taxpayer to file on behalf of the people of the state. It makes violation an unfair labor practice under ORS 243-672. It requires the Employment Relations Board to fine public employers found in violation of the measure of an amount equal to triple the funds the employer expended on the prohibited activities. And it specifies that in the petition for representation, at least 30% of the employees must sign the petition.
Okay, thanks for that explanation. And I see Alana Guinea. Would you like to come forward? Good afternoon, and welcome to the Senate Rules Committee.
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ilana Guinea here on behalf of the Oregon AFL-CIO. I think we've tried to narrow how many people testify on this bill each time it's heard in an effort to remain efficient. So today you have just me. I apologize that we don't have a member here who could share their story about why this bill is needed. We have occasional egregious cases and a few small cases in between where we have seen workers interested in organizing a union go up against employers who spend public dollars to bring in outside consultants at very large fees to tell them how to prevent a union from forming. For the workers who face that, it is incredibly difficult, and it's also, more importantly, we believe a pretty huge waste of the limited resources that we have that your colleagues on our Ways and Means Committees give to these various entities that should be used for program. On the flip side, this bill talks specifically about neutrality. We don't believe that those funds should be used to encourage workers to organize either. We believe that public dollars should be used for public services, for the needs that they are distributed for, and not in any way on either side to support or to deter workers from forming a union. That's why we've brought this bill for you today. Just a couple of clarifications about the bill and the Dash 3 amendments. Much of the changes in the Dash 3 amendments come out of conversations with the League of Cities and others about concerns that they had with the original bill, and these amendments represent a compromise and a coming together on what this bill really needed to say to work for both parties. That is in part why enforcement was moved from BOLI to the Employment Relations Board. That whole list of changes you heard in the description after the information about moving enforcement to the Employment Relations Board was to put the process in line with how other processes within the Employment Relations Board work. We had to change a lot of how enforcement happened within the bill to make it in line with what usually happens within that board. There is also within this bill a section near the end that ensures that the process for union organizing is consistent. Right now there are two different processes. If workers are forming a new union, the process that they have for organizing is different than if a group of workers is looking to add themselves to an existing union. That difference causes a lot of confusion. It has created some conflicts before. That confusion can slow things down and cost the state dollars as well, so we're just trying to clear that up and make sure that everybody's going through the same process. And I also should note that the change in timeline that was noted in the description for forming a union through the Employment Relations Board through majority sign-up was part of the agreement to ensure that enforcement of the main provisions of the bill worked when we moved them to the Employment Relations Board. I'm happy to answer any technical questions about the bill or the amendment, as well as give more information about examples where this has been a problem if there are any questions. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you for your clear explanation. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Senator Burdick. Madam Chair, just a comment. I want to thank you for working with the others and with me to really narrow this down to the problem of hiring outside people with public funds, and I'm happy to support it. Thank you.
Chair Rosenbaum, Senator Burdick, thank you for working with us to figure out the best way to word the bill.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions? Okay, it looks like you've answered them all, so thanks very much for being so brief and clear.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. And is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3342 or the -3 amendments thereto? Welcome back.
Chair Rosenbaum, thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Winkles, and I represent the League of Oregon Cities. I want to thank my friend Alana for working with us to address some of our concerns with the bill. We do believe moving the enforcement and the rulemaking process back into the Employment Relations Board process is more appropriate for some legal and technical reasons. We understand that the incident that brought this bill was related to U of O, and this isn't really a practice that's been prevalent among cities, and so we simply wanted to address some very technical concerns with the bill, and I appreciate them for doing that, and we do not object to its passage. We're neutral on the bill.
Okay, so it sounds like you had some previous concerns that were addressed in these -3 amendments. Is that correct,
Chair Rosenbaum? We did. Those were largely of we perceived them as of a technical nature.
Great. And your position is that you're neutral on the bill,
Chair Rosenbaum? Correct.
Okay. Thank you for your clarification. Thank you for being here. Any questions? Okay. Thank you, Ian.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 3342? Okay, I don't see anybody else who wants to testify, and unfortunately our fiscal impact did not quite catch up with our amendment today, so we will carry this bill over to tomorrow. We're tentatively scheduled to meet at 9:30 in the morning. And I will close the work session on House Bill 3342, and that completes our agenda. So stay tuned for our posting of our agenda for tomorrow, and with nothing further to come before us today, we are adjourned.